I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This week's cover of Time magazine is gasp-inducing. It's a portrait of a beautiful 18-year-old Afghan girl with a gaping hole where her nose was cut off by the Taliban, the same Taliban the Afghan government is seeking reconciliation with. The picture has set blogs on fire. If this is what the Taliban is doing now to punish a girl for fleeing abusive in-laws, what happens when U.S. troops begin their drawdown in July 2011, as President Obama proposes? What happens to emerging women's voices, like that of Mojda Jamalzadeh?
سلام به شما سلام چطور هستین سلام خوش اومدین به برنامه مجد بینندگان عزیز باز هم خوش اومدین
That's the Mojda show. The host, 26-year-old Mojda Jamalzadeh, was born in Kabul, raised in Canada. She returned to her home country last year to host the variety show, and like her hero Oprah, has taken up issues forbidden by the Taliban. She joins us now for a couple of minutes. And Mojda, first of all, do you even dare raise an issue such as the kind of abuse by the Taliban on the cover of Time on your show?
Yes, I definitely would, Robin. The reason that I'm here, putting myself at risk, putting my own life at risk, is to try to make a difference.
How do you even raise an issue like abuse with the Taliban and very conservative clergy listening in on your show?
It's a very difficult thing to do. By having the Mojda show, we're trying to ease people into realizing things. We're not a political show. We try to indirectly talk about things, not too harshly, because if you're too harsh, what they do is the government will drop the show immediately. So we have to, you know, take different ways into it.
One example of how you bring these subjects up is the subject of divorce. Divorce is permitted by the Quran, but talking about it is taboo. How did you get people to start talking about that? Because initially, when you brought it up in a live session with a studio audience, they didn't want to talk about it.
Yes, I knew that we were going to have problems with it. And the fact that we had an audience, I was very surprised. And I went into the audience and I said, do any of you have questions for the psychiatrist? And nobody was willing to raise a hand and everybody's heads just went, you know, looking down. And I didn't know what to do. So I went down there and I said, oh, nobody has the guts to ask a question. And I heard somebody say, well, we're not going to get a divorce. I said, no, this isn't talking about whether you are going to get a divorce. And they started laughing. So I had to make the audience calm down about it and, you know, get them laughing. And finally, one hand went up. But there were no females asking questions at all.
Well, there have been a lot of advances for women. 25% of parliament is now required to be female, but we understand not all female lawmakers support women's rights. There was a law passed last summer with those lawmakers allowing Shiite husbands to withhold money and food from wives who withhold sex. What else are you hearing is happening to women?
Actually, the lady that helps around the house, she couldn't come to work for a few days. When she came back for work after 3 days, I saw her eyes were bruised. Some parts of her hair was missing. Her shoulder was completely dislocated. And I said, what happened? She said, my husband beat me. And she burst into tears. This is something that happens regularly, on a regular basis, to a lot of women here. And it just, you know, it breaks my heart.
Well, we understand working women are getting so-called night letters threatening them with violence and telling them to stop working.
Yes.
Female politicians and women's rights activists being attacked and killed. And you wrote a song for the female students who had acid thrown in their faces. This was the hit song Afghan Girl. And we have a little bit of it, you performing it at the White House for International Women's Day back in the spring. Mojda, what do those lyrics mean? What did you say in that song?
The song mentions very powerful female names who have gone down in history in Afghanistan. And they have schools named after them, and they have streets named after them. And I say, I'm a girl, I'm an Afghan girl, don't break my wings, don't break my honor.
Yeah. Well, and that's history, but now the Afghan government talking about reconciliation. What happens to your show if too many concessions are made to the Taliban?
Actually, I'm very fearful of what's going to happen to my show. Right now, we've actually had a couple of threats that my show is going to be dropped based on the issues that we're discussing, and they don't like it. The way I'm dressed, the way that I stand there and talk to people, the way I make the audience get involved in discussing the subject, it's actually showing female empowerment. And I'm getting the females to stand up and discuss these things or ask questions. And I think that they're being threatened.
Yeah. Well, and of course, the show is a symbol of women in general. President Karzai told a human rights advocate, what's more important, saving a girl's life or saving her right to go to school? In other words, should he fight to get rights for women or accommodate some of the Taliban's requests, let's say no education, just to keep the women from getting killed or their noses cut off? Does he have a point? I mean, does there have to be perhaps some...
One or the other?
Yeah.
As a president, I don't think that he should give that kind of choice. I think that they shouldn't have to choose between one or the other. But they should have the right to go to school and they should have the right to live as well.
That's Mojda Jamalzadeh. She's a host of the Mojda Show in Afghanistan. She's been speaking to us from Kabul. Mojda, thanks very much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Well, there's more tension between North and South Korea today as the South opens naval drills near the spot where that South Korean warship sank 4 months ago. A team of investigators concluded that North Korea sank the ship. The North says they didn't, and that these naval drills could reignite a war on the Korean Peninsula. Well, our next guest has seen this minuet before. It usually begins with one step forward, as in breakthroughs in the Clinton administration or through former President Jimmy Carter. Then one step back, George W. Bush labels the North part of the axis of evil. Or North Korea lies about its nuclear capabilities, kills a South Korean tourist, allegedly sinks a ship, or sends arms to South Africa, as our next guest writes, shoots itself in both feet. Walter Clemens is professor of political science at Boston University. He's also an associate at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. His new, heavily detailed book borrows from that bestseller about negotiating. Walter's book is called Getting to Yes in Korea, and we're going to spend a few minutes with him today. Professor Clemens, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you start at the end almost, put this book in context for us? Where exactly are we in the six-country talks and in relations with Korea?
Well, first of all, South Korea has become one of the most successful industrializing, modernizing countries. And by contrast, their cousins in the North are essentially living in a failed state with a few nuclear devices. Their ability to get by with testing these nuclear devices puts enormous stress on the nuclear proliferation regime, and so we worry about that.
Right, and are we talking?
There are off and on negotiations. Recently at Panmunjom, U.S. and North Korean military officers have been talking about this sinking of the South Korean ship, how to prove that one side or the other sunk that ship. Occasionally, there's an envoy from the United States that meets with North Korean leaders, but the North Koreans have been unwilling to return to the six-party talks. They say they're willing, but something always comes up that they haven't shown up yet.
You're right. What some of the challenges are that Washington now faces. I'm just going to trip through this paragraph because it's just fascinating. You write, the questions are, was the North shaped by a unique blend of Confucianism and communism? Or was it a mafia-style family business? Was the core ideology nothing but a paranoid, racist nationalism, a teaching that the Korean people are too pure-blooded and therefore too virtuous to survive in this evil world without a great parental leader? And was that parent the stern patriarch of a fatherland or the dear and somewhat feminine leader of caring motherland, which is evidenced in a poster of Kim Jong-il, which is titled, We Cannot Live Far Away From His Breast? Just a couple last questions. You write, did Pyongyang fear the U.S. or despise and ridicule its empty threats? Did North Koreans cross the Tumen River to reach freedom or merely to acquire cell phones and DVD players? Those really some of the unanswered questions that negotiators have.
Negotiators and American citizens. For me, the overarching dilemma is, can you negotiate with a government that permits its own people to starve?
But then you also ask, can you afford to not negotiate with, right, a government that allows its people to starve?
I get at this whole thing from my experience trying to study U.S. relations with the Soviet Union. And at times, the Soviet government has been pretty repulsive. But you're talking with weapons that could end humanity. So it seems pretty important to try to regulate these things.
Well, in fact, you make these comparisons to other big negotiations. And the other questions that you pose, I mean, there are so many of them, include, should U.S. presidents ever talk to the bad guys? And you say, well, we did.
Yeah, well, we did. Sometimes it worked.
Reagan is an example with Russia?
Well, not only Reagan, but most American presidents since Dwight Eisenhower have reached some sort of understandings with the Soviet regime. On balance, I think those understandings were helpful to both sides.
Richard Nixon clinking glasses with Mao, who you say Mao did, you know, as bad things to his people, Kim Jong-il did to his.
Yeah, there's a moral dilemma here. I find it rather repulsive for Nixon to be clinking glasses with a man that permitted at least 30 million Chinese to starve. But you're dealing with the fate of the world, relations between two great powers and their weapons. So I guess it's important to reach some kind of practical accords. Just to go back to the Soviet Union for a second, these various accords helped to bring down the Soviet regime.
But it was already on its way. And I'm wondering, does that also, because, you know, the question you pose is, should there be negotiation with North Korea, or is it about to collapse from within?
It's very hard to know how long that government can continue to exist. In the meantime, it seems to me that any kind of negotiations somehow help to open the system, and they may even do some good in terms of regulating nuclear weapons.
Well, let's talk about that, nuclear weapons, because another question that you pose, they're also provocative, is should the U.S. demand that North Korea be stripped of any weapon capability or allow North Korea to have just a little bit so that they can feel safe? Obviously, they're feeling, like, what did you say, like a fish among sharks in their region of the world. And so maybe just let them have a little bit so they can, you know, save face or feel safe. What's your answer?
Zero is the best answer. In the meantime, if we could freeze their system so that they were able to keep whatever they have and not expand it, that would be better than achieving no agreement at all. By the way, the Iranians seem to be in some way emulating the North Korean model, promising things in the negotiation, but they keep working on their nuclear weapon program, and they may hope to follow the North Korean model, so it's important for us, I think, to at least check the North Korean development so as not to provide sort of a bad example for Iran.
Get it right in North Korea, in other words. And Walter Clemens, you say to do that, one has to know the history. So let's just take a second here. In the late 1800s, Korea had a good relationship with the U.S. In fact, Thomas Edison went to Seoul and installed electricity. But when Japan occupied Korea in the early 1900s, the U.S. just stood by. No American president mentioned Korea publicly between 1911 and 1942 because the Japanese gave the Americans a free hand in the Philippines. But then, during World War II, the Allies asked the Soviets to go into Korea through the north to drive the Japanese out. But that led to the proxy war in the Cold War era, the U.S. backing the south, the Chinese and Soviets the north. It ends in the division we now know, with an odd fusion in the north of Confucianism and communism, and a country led by one family since then. Walter Clemens' new book is Getting to Yes in Korea, so how to do that, we'll ask in about a minute. Also, later today, those genetically modified mosquitoes, can they wipe out malaria? But back in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Walter Clemens. He's a professor of political science at Boston University and an associate at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian Studies, Russian and Eurasian Studies. His new book is Getting to Yes in Korea. And Professor Clemens, there's a section called How to Transform the Game. Replace confrontation with a strategy to reduce tensions, pursue value creation rather than value claiming, accent the positive, you know, with carrots while using every stick to prevent nuclear proliferation. And again, this all comes from the book that your book borrows a title from, the bestseller about negotiating, Getting to Yes. And it all sounds great, but why hasn't it worked?
I'm afraid that one answer is the Republicans. In the mid-1990s, the Clinton administration struck a so-called agreed framework with North Korea, whereby they froze their plutonium production, and in exchange, we were supposed to build them two small nuclear reactors and give them some oil until the reactors were ready. The Republicans in Congress refused to pay for the oil, and the Americans had to go begging to the European Union to subsidize the oil. Turns out we did not even break ground on these reactors until 2002, 8 years after the agreed framework was signed. So each side has done things to impede progress. For us, the unfortunate thing is you hardly ever see in the American press how the North Koreans look at these various accords.
Well, let's just take that one example, because years later, when George W. Bush, after calling North Korea part of the axis of evil, prompted in part by Condoleezza Rice, kind of late in the administration, to decide that perhaps maybe part of the Bush legacy should be forging some kind of relationship with North Korea. His own people, John Bolton, his one of his representatives, said I can't remember the exact quote, but that he'd lost his mind or something. Mm-hmm. You know, when Republicans did try, they had some resistance within their own party because, you know, there's a feeling that you're not dealing with a sane counterpart in North Korea, that it's far too dangerous to give them things like nuclear plants for power because they'll take the product as they've done and turn it into weapons. How do you overcome that feeling that, in addition to whatever ideology there's some insanity in North Korea as well?
I don't think insanity is the right word. There's a possibility that they are unscrupulous and they may lie and deceive, et cetera, et cetera. But most of what they have done can be explained in terms of sort of rational calculation. There's no really simple answer as to, you know, how to get to yes, but you certainly have to be persistent, and you have to establish some kind of credibility. Now, it's important to have also an element of trust. The North Koreans and Koreans in general are much more into personal relationships in negotiations than are Americans.
But what is it about the blend of, as you write, Confucianism, brought early from China, and communism that makes it different than, you know, other negotiations?
Well, there was a professor at MIT who died one or two years ago, Lucian Pai, who wrote about the culture of and the religion of all of Asia. And he believed that Koreans have a somewhat aggressive form of Confucianism, conducive to reckless, risk-taking behavior. You lump that with communism, lump that with pride of Koreans in their own way of life. Somehow you wind up in the North with a government similar to what they have now. North Korea did get a lot of aid from the Soviet Union, but it was not the kind of aid that conduced to self-reliance and self-development.
Yeah. Walter Clemens, you end your book by concluding that getting to yes, and I'm really simplifying here, but has to focus on arms control, but also has to replace economic sanctions with economic assistance. And we just saw Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announcing new sanctions against North Korea when she was in Seoul, opening a door to free trade, liberalizing exchanges across the border between North and South. What is your sense of what is going to actually happen? I mean, that might be the recommendation, but what do you think is going to happen?
I don't believe I can really make any prediction. Do you know that there's a major school of thought that says that the so-called investigation into the sinking of the South Korean ship was not at all reliable? Imagine, this is almost the worst scenario one could imagine for this year, that the South Korean government somehow faked the results of this investigation. If this school of thought is correct, we're punishing the North Koreans for something that they did not do.
Walter Clemens, we'll have to leave it on that provocative thought. But, I guess I can't, because I just really have to ask you once again, do you think that we will get to yes in maybe 10 or 20 years? And do you think it will still be the same family dynasty? Do you think that North Korea can hold up that long?
Most of the governments, something like North Korea, when they've had a succession crisis, some kind of a liberal, softer regime emerges. This happened after Stalin's death in 1953. It happened after Mao Zedong's death in 1976. I think it's happening in Cuba. So if that kind of precedent prevails, the son of Kim Jong-il, if he does take power, will be forced by the environment and by people around him to take a more conciliatory line at home and abroad. My own prediction would be that the government will somehow mellow and that sooner or later they will be forced into some kind of a confederation with South Korea. If you consider the economic and military forces on all sides, I think you have to expect the North Korean regime to shrivel.
Walter Clemens, his new book is Getting to Yes in Korea. He's professor of political science at Boston University and associate at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Professor Clemens, thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. Hyper-partisanship, the pressure to raise money, even the presence of C-SPAN have made the U.S. Senate a frustrating place for lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. We'll speak with New Yorker's George Packer about the forces pulling the Senate apart. Also, their angry, upset, and bracing for deportees reaction from Mexico on Arizona's new illegal immigration law. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, a coming-of-age story. It's in the Midwest in the shadow of 9/11. It's from author Lori Moore. The latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
If you see a faded sign at the side of the road that says 15 miles to the
Love Shack! Love Shack screams the front page of the Boston Herald. Shaquille O'Neal is coming here to Boston to play for the Celtics. Another loss for poor Cleveland, but Bostonians are launching a love fest. Then there's A-Rod's 600th homer with an asterisk, and the asterisk that may be in the future for Lance Armstrong as federal investigators ramp up a criminal probe into allegations of doping. Oh, and the bankrupt Texas Rangers are sold at auction. Bob Ryan is sports writer for the Boston Globe. Bob, so much going on. Start with Shaq coming to Boston. You say instead of a bench, the Celtics will have a couch. Ouch.
He's 38, and he'll join fellow basketball geriatrics Ray Allen, Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Jermaine O'Neal, who will turn 32 soon, which is a very old core of players, and which means that the trainer will be very busy. But Shaquille O'Neal represents two things. He represents a ball player, a fading talent, but still formidable at times and still has assets, massive assets, massive liabilities. It's a risk-reward situation when you import him at this stage. And the second thing he brings is personality. He is, without question, the most lovable and accessible big man who has ever played the game. Most big guys are brooding and forbidding. Shaquille O'Neal is one of the most entertaining personalities in the history of this league.
Well, he's already tweeted, hello, Greentown. Okay, what you got for nicknames? Make them good. So people are getting to work to come up with his new nickname.
Oh, the people are hard at work. The ESPN folks have come up with 8 of them for people to vote on. One of my favorites was Saint Shaq-trick.
I like Shaqopotamus myself.
No, I like that.
Thank you. Well, moving to baseball, the auction of the Texas Rangers yesterday, the team's owner, Tom Hicks, defaulted on $525 million in loans. Reports are saying that baseball's happy about the sale to Nolan Ryan, heading up a group. Your thoughts?
Not without precedent. The Orioles were put up for auction back in the 90s, so this is not new ground, but very interesting because Mr. Hicks' stubborn holdout to get his price was making this a very difficult procedure. Major League Baseball, Inc. wanted Nolan Ryan's group to get the team, and Nolan Ryan is a highly favored son. He's been the president of the team, and now he's going to own the team, which I think makes people in Texas very happy. He's an icon down there, and he's a shrewd guy, and who they did not want was Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, who had made a prior bid for the Cubs. And it was made clear, I think, that Major League Baseball was not interested in having his iconoclastic viewpoint on display in baseball as it is in basketball.
Yeah, well, so the former Hall of Fame pitcher, Nolan Ryan, gets the team.
Yep.
Staying with baseball, New York Yankee Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod, hits his 600th homer, but he's an admitted steroid user.
Seventh player to do so, the youngest to achieve that mark. However, this is met with great ennui outside of New York. which kind of manufactured interest in it, primarily because it was so difficult to attain. He hit 599 seemingly years ago, but there's no question that A-Rod's legacy has been stained by the admission of steroid use, and what many people feel is his refusal to come totally clean and admit the full extent of the use. People weren't buying his story, and so we'll never know how many of these home runs were juice-aided, but this is a great, great sports achievement, and it really wasn't greeted very enthusiastically.
Well, then there's Lance Armstrong. During the summer's Tour de France, he said he'll deny any involvement in doping as long as I live. In May, former teammate Floyd Landis launched accusations again. He said Armstrong's team even sold bicycles to help dope him. And we hear federal investigators are now talking to other cyclists.
Yes, it does seem as if the noose is tightening, doesn't it? And he has been steadfast in his denials, and this eyewitness testimony is going to be very compelling, riveting. And the other thing that has always hung over him that is going to make it very difficult for him to win this battle eventually in a court of public opinion is the fact that he had an association with a known dirty Italian doctor who was a drug enabler, a drug procurer, and he was never able to fully extricate himself from that association. That, to me, has always been the most damning things in any indictment one would bring forth against Lance Armstrong. But he is. Here's my prediction, that someday he will be exposed and he will rely on the following as a defense. Hey, I may be bad, but look at all the money I raised for cancer. I'm still a good guy, and that's the way I want to be remembered.
Bob Ryan, sports writer for the Boston Globe, thanks for helping us catch up on the week in sports.
You got it.
And by the way, a reminder, you can always listen to a stream live at hereandnow.org. That's at 12 p.m. East Coast time. Check that out. You can download a podcast there as well. Coming up, the genetically modified mosquito that could wipe out malaria in 30 seconds, Here and Now. Every 30 seconds, a child somewhere in the world dies of malaria. That's more than a million malaria deaths a year in 90 countries with no end in sight. In fact, the number of people dying of malaria today is higher than it was 30 years ago. Despite intense campaigns to eradicate the disease with medication or chemical-treated mosquito netting, well, those grim statistics underscore the importance of some groundbreaking research in Arizona. Now, malaria needs mosquitoes to infect humans, and now scientists have genetically engineered a mosquito completely resistant to the malaria parasite. In other words, this mosquito can't transmit the disease even after being exposed to it. Entomologist Michael Reilly led the team conducting the research. He joins us from his office at the University of Arizona, Tucson. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And tell us, first of all, what did you do to these mosquitoes to make them malaria resistant?
Well, we engineered in a small gene to express specifically in the gut where the malaria parasite is found for most of its life cycle in the mosquito.
And as it expresses in the gut, in other words, when it activates in the gut, what will it do?
Well, it affects innate immunity and lifespan. How it actually kills a malaria parasite, we're not entirely sure, and that's something we're looking into.
Well, and first of all, wow, this has to be tiny detailed work.
Yeah, we're working with mosquito eggs and injecting DNA actually into the eggs themselves. Mm-hmm. So you say,
and others have said, this is 100% effective. You kill the malaria parasite in the gut of these mosquitoes you genetically engineer.
Right. We sent these mosquitoes that we engineered in our lab to our collaborators at UC Davis, and they challenged them with the malaria parasite. And with the mosquitoes that we challenged, we didn't find any surviving malaria parasites in those engineered mosquitoes.
Well, that's amazing in and of itself, and it's being applauded. But now perhaps comes the even harder part, getting those malaria-resistant mosquitoes from your lab into the wild. Now, what are the questions there?
That's obviously a huge challenge, and one of the big technical hurdles we still have to overcome is the mechanism for allowing them to compete effectively in the wild and in order to replace the wild mosquito population.
Yeah, tell us more about that, because you have to make sure that these mosquitoes breed with the regular mosquitoes, but you also have to ensure that all the offspring contain the new gene, because we understand that one of the challenges that you have is that it's a little bit like antibiotics. We're told if we don't take all of our antibiotics, then whatever we're taking them for will build a resistance. Is that the same question you have to address with these mosquitoes?
As far as the resistance is involved, we've taken a step toward solving that because, like you said, if we don't completely block the malaria parasite from developing in the mosquito, if even a few of them can evade this parasite-killing mechanism, resistance will develop very quickly. Mm-hmm. So we were able to completely block that, but you know, any mosquito that's released into the field will probably have several additional parasite killing mechanisms incorporated into it to ensure that if one parasite gets past our mechanism, one of the other ones will be able to kill it.
So what are the challenges?
Once we've engineered this mosquito that's completely resistant to the malaria parasite, we have to develop a way to allow them to replace the wild mosquito population. And there's a few different genetic tricks that are being looked at to ensure that all of the progeny resulting from a genetically engineered mosquito mating with a wild-type mosquito will result in all of the progeny having the anti-malarial gene inherited.
Right. In other words, you want all the little mosquitoes that are born of these malaria-resistant mosquitoes to also be malaria-resistant. Can you put a more of a time frame on when you think this might move out into the field? And once it does, how long do you think it'll take to really have an impact on this terrible statistic about the number of people who die from malaria?
Yeah, there's as to how long it would take, that developing the drive mechanism and the mosquitoes that are completely resistant will probably take 7-8 years. And then you have to field test them and ensure that there's no unanticipated consequences. So they'll probably do semi-field cage experiments somewhere where you have large greenhouses where you can test this entire system out before actually releasing them into the wild. So it's going to be at least a decade, if not more, before this is in the field.
Oh, well, you just mentioned something, unanticipated consequences.
Yes.
Yeah, do you worry about that? I mean, maybe Mother Nature intended for there to be, as awful as it sounds, a malaria parasite. Do you worry that it'll move somewhere else if it can't be in the mosquito? Do you worry that it'll wipe out mosquitoes, which we need for other reasons? I mean, do you worry about what you're doing there?
I'm not too concerned about eliminating the malaria parasite itself because we're targeting the human malaria parasite. There are other malaria parasites out there, bird parasites, primate parasites, mouse parasites. But, you know, we've eliminated other pathogens such as smallpox without any major consequences.
Do you worry, though, that it will find another home?
I think that's pretty unlikely. The malaria life cycle is really complicated and very specific to the mosquito. Mm. But with that being said, you know, this is by no means a magic bullet. It's probably not going to eliminate malaria completely anyways. It's just another tool that we can use to help control it as insecticides and drugs are beginning to fail.
You know, there are unintended consequences, so, you know, we may not know what they are, but what are some that you worry about?
Well, you know, we put a very small change in the mosquito genetically. So we don't anticipate any major changes to the mosquito or anything like that.
A 6-foot-tall mosquito.
Exactly. You know, the odds are incredibly, incredibly unlikely. But we do have to be concerned that if we do introduce this mosquito, it doesn't become a vector for some other disease that could be important. So we'll have to take that into consideration because we are releasing large numbers of these mosquitoes in order to replace the wild population.
How many genetically modified mosquitoes do you think you need to release to have an effect?
That will really depend on how effective our genetic drive system is, but I think the usual estimates used in models is anywhere from 1% to 5% of the population to allow the mosquitoes to ultimately replace the wild mosquito population.
Yeah. You said you don't think that it'll completely eradicate malaria, but do you think you could even achieve your goal of making a dent in the number of malaria cases without doing this? I mean, as we said, yes, there are chemicals and there's education about mosquitoes and water and things like that, but they haven't made a dent.
No, they haven't. And actually, you know, a lot of the commonly used drugs and insecticides are becoming less and less effective as time goes on.
And more harmful to the environment. So.
Yeah, and there was a great example, and there's a new drug, anti-malarial drug called artemisinin, that was going to be the next big thing, inexpensive, very effective against malaria, and resistance is already developed in some areas against that. So coming up with new strategies that don't rely on insecticides and drugs would be, like I said, another tool that we can use to try to combat malaria.
That's entomologist Michael Reilly, principal researcher with the team that recently developed a malaria-resistant mosquito in a collaborative project between the University of Arizona and UC Davis. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
And by the way, I just said mosquitoes serve purposes, and I could just hear you saying, like, what? Well, bats and fish rely on them for food, for one thing, so there. Before we go today, our continuing effort to provide you with a great summer reading list with a terrific novel from Laurie Moore that's headed for paperback. That's in a minute, here and now. If you're looking for some good fiction this summer, how about author Lori Moore? Her latest novel, A Gate at the Stairs, goes to paperback this month. The New York Times used words like haunting and memorable to describe it. One reviewer said, "I wanted to turn to the person nearest to me and shout, 'You must read this book!'" Well, while we were reading, we also wanted to shout at the characters, "Look out! Pay attention." At the center, 20-year-old Tassie Keltkin, who leaves the family potato farm for a big Midwestern college.
I had come from Delacrosse Central High, from a small farm on the Paraville Road, to this university town of Troy, the Athens of the Midwest, as if from a cave, like the priest child of a Colombian tribe I'd read about in cultural anthropology, a boy made mystical by being kept in the dark for the bulk of his childhood and allowed only stories, no experience of the outside world. Once brought out into light, he would be in a perpetual holy condition of bedazzlement and wonder. No story would ever have been equal to the thing itself, and so it was with me. Nothing had really prepared me, not the college piggy bank in the dining room, the savings bonds from my grandparents, or the used set of World Book encyclopedias with their beautiful colored charts of international wheat production and photographs of presidential birthplaces. The flat green world of my parents' hogless, horseless farm, its dullness, its flies, its quiet, ripped open daily by the fumes and whining of machinery, twisted away and left me with a brilliant city life of books and films and witty friends. Someone had turned on the lights. Someone had led me out of the cave of Paraville Road.
In addition to learning about Chaucer, Sylvia Plath, Sufism, Tassie gets a job as a nanny, taking care of a soon-to-be-adopted biracial child she grows to love but must leave. Lori Moore also has a biracial adopted child, and she teaches English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But she says the book isn't autobiographical, so what is it about? We spoke with Lori Moore last summer from Wisconsin Public Radio. I asked her, when in her writing did she know this was such a good story?
Oh, one never knows. One never knows. I mean, there's several stories in the novel. I mean, most novels have several sort of overlapping stories.
Yeah. Well, and we haven't even mentioned one, and that's partly because I'm embarrassed to say I forgot about it as I was reading. And that's the 9/11 connection.
Well, the novel takes place between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. So there's this sort of quiet but ominous period.
Well, and you give us a couple of signposts along the way, but as I admitted, I forgot it. And it feels as if some of the characters did as well, or at least they weren't paying as much attention, especially maybe out in the Midwest, away from Ground Zero, busy, trying to have careers and children, as players off stage are going to war.
Well, yeah, in a way. In the Midwest, after 9/11, there was recruitment of kids from high schools. I mean, I'm sure this happened in the rest of the country as well. But as the country was sort of gearing up for this invasion, you know, things started to happen. And, you know, people were being, you know, lifted up and taken off. And the novel ends with the student protests that began of this particular foreign policy moment.
Well, in between, Tassie is maybe a lot like me reading it. She's not really paying much attention to the drumbeat. She's going to college.
Well, she is a sort of typical girl who comes to college and finds everything sort of awesome and sophisticated and intellectually stimulating. She's thinking a lot about what does it all mean. Nobody's smarter than people in their 20s. I teach them here, so I know that they're smart. So the challenge for me was to try to, at my age, to try to be as smart as someone in their 20s and try to sort of latch on to things they might be thinking about.
Well, and you nail Tassie's struggles to try to understand her new employer, a glamorous owner of a gourmet restaurant in this fictional college town, you know, juggling, adopting a child with work. She's like an alien to Tassie, whose own mom is an eccentric farmer's wife who puts mirrors in her garden to make it look like there are more flowers.
I think there's a parallel between Tassie's mother, who she also desires to you know, kind of run away from and separate herself from, and Sarah. And that connection is made early on when Tassie realizes that the woman she's babysitting for is the same age as her mother. And so in my mind, I had them sort of be similar women with different wigs on and different outfits and different glasses and different styles of speech, but in my mind they were sort of played by the same actress. They were the mother characters in this novel.
Huh.
I think this is about people struggling to do the right thing and finding their own limitations. And of course some of these characters have greater limitations than others.
Yeah. There's also the trademark Laurie Moore hilarity. I was reminded, I was browsing around online and someone mentioned a line you used in an earlier one of your short stories. The character says, "I was having a dream about you and suddenly I woke up with a jerk and felt very uneasy." And the reply, "Yeah, I hate to wake up with jerks." There's that kind of, I mean, Tassie, her roommate gives her as a gift a sexual toy, which Tassie absentmindedly uses to stir her chocolate milk.
Well, that's just in the world. I don't really feel that I'm using it. I feel like I'm unearthing it and discovering it and collecting it.
And it rubs up against some terrible sadness. The title of Laurie Moore's book, A Gate at the Stairs, baby gates were all over the house where Tassie's the nanny. It also looks like on the cover, a stair rising to heaven is...
A gate at the stairs is a barrier to ascension. It's also a kind of protective device. When Tassie goes to interview, she sees that the gate at the stairs that she goes down is broken. And it's a clue to her that, I don't know, it's just a warning. It's like an omen.
Hmm.
This book is not for everybody. No novel is for everyone. And I've heard from those people, too. So
saying what? Saying what?
That it's too... You know, that it's too dark. It's just too dark. But I understand that.
And part of that darkness involves children. And you go there. I thought that as I read it, how hard it must have... It's hard to read. How hard must it have been to live with that for a while?
Well, it was very hard to write some of the scenes, and I felt that perhaps I was avoiding them, and that's what took so long to complete the book. But... Yeah, things happening to children, that's a kind of standby in literature, and because it's the thing, you know, adults most fear, something, you know, happening to young people. And of course, when you have a wartime situation, it's all young people who are paying the price for that. And so I wanted all of that to sort of go in, like all the things you most dread and all the things that shouldn't happen, I decided I would make happen.
So. The things we weren't paying attention to. Laurie Moore, A Gate at the Stairs. Thank you so much for speaking with us about it.
Oh, thank you, Robin.
Author Laurie Moore. We spoke with her last summer about her latest novel, A Gate at the Stairs, which will be coming out in paperback later this month. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.